322-0460, Frederick Gibson et al., appellants versus Cove Condominium Association and Bender Management, appellees.
Mr. Lubin, you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Judge, Justices. May it please the court, counsel, thank you very much for agreeing to hear this. It's exciting for me. Normally, I practice in the First District where we don't get oral arguments, so this is fun. Thank you very much, and the counsels as well. I think the issues have gotten somewhat complicated in the briefing, but I want to focus on what I think really is the simple issue that the briefing puts before the court, which is, was there foundation for the votes? And secondly, was plaintiff prevented from getting the evidence necessary to potentially attack that foundation or potentially attack the votes? And I really think that's kind of the central issue. The briefing, particularly from Bender, spent a lot of time discussing some of the arguments in summary judgment that really were not argued here. The main argument that was argued here, both in the, I think, in the opening brief and in the reply, was really just those two things. There may be some other issues that are floating around there, but that's really it.
Counsel, you're going to need to address the motion to dismiss because we took it with the case as moved.
Absolutely, yeah, I absolutely will address that. I got to remind myself to do that and leave enough time to do it. But basically, bottom line is, we have a Celotex type summary judgment motion. And what that means is that sometimes some summary judgment motions say, you know, you're not going to prove your case because here are the facts, and they simply, you know, they defy one of the elements of your case, and that's that. A Celotex motion says something else. It says you're not going to be able to produce enough evidence to get this before a judge or a jury. And when there's a Celotex type motion, the issue then therefore is there enough evidence? So that means two things. It means with respect to a 191B affidavit that all of the requirements, the typical requirements of a 191B affidavit are relaxed. And I know that this is a big issue in the briefing. The 191B affidavit, you're supposed to say, here's what Malik would have said had he been permitted to testify. And we were attacked for not being able to provide that. Well, the reason we weren't able to provide that is because we have no idea what Malik would have said had he been permitted to testify. And so we couldn't very well write in an affidavit, you know, I swear that this is true. Here's what Malik would have said had he been permitted to testify. We were prevented from getting that information. And in a Celotex type motion, and I cited a case in my reply, in a Celotex type motion, we don't have to say what Malik would have said had he been permitted to testify. That turns 191B from a protection for plaintiffs into a weapon that defendants can use to defeat or to win summary judgment. We were prevented from getting that information out of him. So what we presented in a 191B affidavit, exactly what we're required to present in a 191B affidavit in a Celotex type summary judgment motion, is here is what we were prevented from learning, and here's what we potentially could have learned. And what we potentially could have learned, by the way, is how the votes were counted. And that's critical, because
counsel, you were prevented from learning that because the questions were refused to be answered or instructed not to be answered in the deposition, correct?
Correct.
And did you file a motion to compel before the trial judge with regards to those questions?
Yes, I believe we did. I believe that was one of the motions that was denied, along with the summary judgment.
Okay, go on.
I'll check the record during my break to make sure I'm right about that. But I think that's one of the motions that was denied, along with the summary judgment, was that motion to compel. And so, you know, what the court found was that Malik laid the proper foundation for the votes by saying that he supervised the votes. But all that he said was that he supervised the votes. When push came to shove, when we were able to ask him a couple questions before we were cut off from asking him any more questions, what he says is, I have no idea who counted the votes. I know that it came to a specific specific email address. I don't know what happened if people were asked to change their votes, because I wasn't the one that counted them. I simply supervised the process. And by the way, who did you supervise? I don't know. I can't answer that. And then he was barred from testifying, you know, anymore. Now, in any other context, when I say in any other context, I mean, if the deponent wasn't an attorney, if the person laying the foundation wasn't an attorney, in any other context, I think it'd be fairly clear that wouldn't be sufficient foundation, right? Foundation is a loose term. I'm citing U.S. versus Penzola, 648 F3rd 539, simply a loose term for preliminary questions designed to establish that evidence is admissible. And by the way, the reason I'm citing a Seventh Circuit case instead of an Illinois case is that there isn't quite a lot of case law about what foundation is. But foundation tends to be, you know, how is it that you know these documents are what you claim they are? Or how do you know that this testimony is what you're claiming it is? Normally, what that would mean is I have to be able to say, well, I supervise this and this and this person. And by the way, that would then allow us to say, all right, fine. Can we depose those people and figure out what their policies were? Or when we ask a question like, and by the way, what was your policy for collecting the votes? What was your policy for allowing people to change votes? Those answers certainly are probative. There's no question they're probative. And if we're not allowed to even get to that, there simply is not enough foundation for the votes. And the votes are not self-authenticating documents, right? The votes were not propounded by the people that actually signed the votes. They were propounded by someone claiming that these were the votes. And all through the briefing, the statement is, well, you have the votes. They're right there. Why don't you count them? You know, if why are you telling us that we have to count them? Why don't you count them? That's not our argument. The argument is, we don't know that those votes are the right votes. We don't know that there were votes that came in afterwards. We don't know that the people that signed those votes were owners as opposed to renters. We don't know what system was put in place to make sure that those things were taken care of, because we weren't able to ask. And so in any other circumstance, for example, if Claudia Moore had counted the votes, and there's a reason why I mentioned her counting the votes, because that was what we were told initially, right? Ari, who's the president of the condo association, he said Claudia Moore counted the votes. She was in charge of counting the votes. She was kind of sort of the building manager. But, you know, we were told she counted the votes. Fine, so we could pose those questions to her. And I don't think there'd be an argument in the world that we're not allowed to ask her all of the questions that we tried to ask Malik. The reason that Malik was an issue is, I think, because he was an attorney. Right, he's the attorney, so therefore certain things are attorney-client. But in this case, Malik wasn't the attorney. Malik was a witness. He was a witness to probably the most important question that was before the court, which is, were these votes counted in an appropriate fashion, and did you in fact get 75% of the vote necessary to do a condo deconversion? We don't know the answer to that question. Today, we don't know the answer to that question. We don't know, did anyone attempt to change the vote? What happened when they tried to do that? We don't know the individuals of the people that counted the votes. We don't know what policy was put in place to make sure that the people who were voting were, because a lot of the, and I think it was more than a majority of the condos were the residents in the condos were not the owners. They were renters. In some cases, it was an LLC that owned. You know, do we know that the person that voted was a proper representative of the LLC? We don't know any of those answers because we were prevented from getting those from getting that information. And of course, if Claudia Moore was the one that actually had counted the votes, as we were told initially by the defendants, we 100% we would have been allowed to get that information. I don't think there's an argument in the world, and certainly no argument that was made by the appellees in this case, that we wouldn't have been entitled to that information if it was Claudia Moore. The only reason that we weren't able to get that information is because, oh, what do you know? The witness is an attorney. But there's no privilege in this one. The witness is a witness, and he should have been allowed to testify about all those things. And the fact that he testified about all those things means that there wasn't any foundation laid. And if he can't say who counted it, all he can say is that I supervised it. What does supervision mean exactly? We don't even know that. And the court accepted, of course, that the votes were counted properly because Malik, who's an attorney, laid the foundation by saying I supervised. With respect to the trial court, That's not sufficient foundation to admit that evidence. And by the way, if that's not sufficient foundation to admit that evidence, then we don't have evidence that 75% of the people voted X, Y, or Z. And so therefore, summary judgment should not have been granted. Okay, so I'll turn for a second. I mean, unless there are any questions about that, I think it's a relatively straightforward issue, for better or for worse. I'll turn to the motion to dismiss. Okay, so after summary judgment was entered, the owners were told, you know, now's the time to sign. The sale's going to go through anyway. The court said that's happening. And so the sale's going to go through anyway, whether you like it or not, whether you sign or not. If you want your money, sign. And that's what they did. And we have an affidavit that says exactly that. And that affidavit, I don't think was refuted. I mean, I realize it was in a reply. And so maybe it couldn't have been refuted. But if information was otherwise, I think it would have been both in the motion to dismiss or in the two responses. And it wasn't. So I think that's more or less what happened, and it makes sense. That's not a goofy story. That makes sense. They were told sign or else. The court said that they were going to lose their condos, and the Bender nominees said sign or else. Why do I call it the Bender nominees? Really simple. The document, the contract that was entered into, required whoever purchased the property to either be Bender or be someone who has the same, you know, one of the same principles as Bender. And that's exactly what happens here, by the way. The company Medina, which purchased the condominium association, was created for the purpose of purchasing the condominium association. It was created for the purpose of being something other than Bender. But in order to purchase the condominium association, according to the contract that the court approved, it had to be a nominee of Bender. If it was not a nominee of Bender, then it wouldn't have been permitted to make the purchase. And so, you know, I don't think that argument really even gets off the ground. It's right as one. If it wasn't a nominee of Bender, it doesn't comply with the contract. If it is a nominee of Bender, then the case isn't moot. Bender's still the party, essentially, through Medina. So I don't know that argument gets off the ground. Turning to a couple, and by the way, if there's any questions about that, I'll entertain them before I go and move on. Now, hearing nothing, this is so awkward, by the way, the Zoom thing. I really like human beings. It's nice to be in the same room with them. I just see a bunch of boxes with heads in them. What I wanted to turn to is a couple of the other arguments, mostly in the Bender response. You know, I think one of the arguments that they claim that, well, one argument that they claim, and I want to get it out of the way, is in terms of the 341 argument, where they claim that we should be paying sanctions because all these statements were made that were inadmissible and whatnot. They weren't relied on. And I think you heard a second ago, my argument now is fairly straightforward. It has to do with the foundation for the votes. It doesn't have to do with you know, we had, you know, 18 some odd clients that each had individual issues that all made their way into affidavits. Most of those things weren't really argued even in summary judgment, and none of them were argued on appeal, really, other than the issue of the votes and the foundation for the votes. So that one, I think, is a non-starter. I mean, what's in front of the court, you know, up or down, if the court likes my argument or not. But what's in front of the court, I think, is a fairly discreet question, and not the various, you know, the various questions that were being referred to and refuted in the Bender argument. The other Bender argument, the other biggie, was that this isn't a proper derivative action, and it's not. It's not a derivative action, right? These people's homes were being taken away from them as a result of this process. And so they sued on their own behalfs in order to protect their homes from being taken away from them as a result of this process. It's 100% not a derivative action. And, you know, and so whether it's a proper derivative action, I think is kind of beside the point. It's each was suing in their own capacity. Now, what is true is that if they win their lawsuit, if we win this appeal and it goes back down and we're able to muster the evidence, if we win this lawsuit, then the sale will be reversed and that will affect the rights of everybody. That's definitely true. But that doesn't make it a derivative lawsuit, right? The lawsuit is really about their rights in their own personal properties rather than their own real properties. So it's not derivative at all. And by the way, for that very reason, since everyone's rights will be affected, I see. Is that a yellow light? Okay.
That's a yellow light.
Thank you. For that very reason, Bender is a necessary party because everyone's rights will be affected, including Bender's. Bender spent a lot of time saying we didn't do anything wrong. For the purposes of appeal, that's fine. I agree. But in as much as people's rights in property are being affected here, including Bender's, they absolutely are a necessary party, right? They deserve to have a seat at the table. I mean, I think they deserve to lose. But they deserve to have a seat at the table. So the argument is either one or the other. Either, you know, we don't deserve to have a seat at the table, and therefore we're not a necessary party, or we do deserve to have a seat at the table. And by the way, they spent a lot of time arguing about all their rights, which they should. But in that case, they're a necessary party. So that's why they're here. I don't think there's anything wrong with that. And the fact that we don't claim fault in them doesn't mean that there's some deficiency in our appeal or in our summary judgment argument.
Counsel, did I hear you correctly that the individuals, the plaintiffs, have all signed the contract and received compensation for the condos?
I believe that is the case. That's what was alleged by Bender. I was not able to find anything to the contrary. So I believe that is the case. And
have they not forfeited their rights?
They were forced to do that. I mean, if you put a gun to my head and say, give me all your money, I don't forfeit my right to ask you for it back. They were forced to do that because of the summary judgment motion going not their way, going Bender's way, and going going the way of the condominium association. And they were told, essentially, you know, sign or you don't get your money. We're going to take your apartment, but you're not going to get your money. That's not a real choice. So respectfully, I don't think they made a choice. I think they did what they had to do.
So if they signed, you're trying to say they would get nothing?
That is what they were told. I don't know whether that's correct. It doesn't make sense to me. That's what they were told, and that's why they signed. And I have the affidavit that says that. And, okay. You know, if I had been part of that process, I don't know what advice I would have given. Thankfully, I wasn't part of that process, and so I didn't have to give advice. But that's what I was told. That's what was put in the affidavit. And for what it's worth, there hasn't been any evidence to the contrary. I see my time is up. If there are any other questions, I'll take them. Otherwise, I'll be quiet.
Any questions from the bench?
None for me.
None. Thank you very much.
You'll have time in reply.
Thank you.
Okay. Ms. Forte, you may respond.
May it please the court. Monica Forte on behalf of Bender Management. As we have argued, this court lacks jurisdiction to hear this appeal. As Mr. Lubin just acknowledged, as we have set forth at length, each one of the plaintiffs has relinquished any ownership interest that they did have or claimed to have in any of the units of the association. For all intents and purposes, the association doesn't exist, and the unit owners are no longer members of the association. Now, while Mr. Lubin continues to argue that this is not a derivative claim, the gravamen of what they are seeking can only be described as derivative in nature, because it does impact every member, or former member in this case, of the association. And because these unit owners have transferred their rights in the units, there is no association, they have no association rights, there is no actual controversy that still exists for this court to adjudicate. We therefore asked that the matter be dismissed for that basis. Now, the association also filed a Rule 305 motion to dismiss because of, again, the sale of these units. Council argues that Bender Management, that Medina Terrace is somehow a nominee of Bender Management. That's not correct. As established by the information we've provided, Bender Management has no ownership interest in Medina Terrace. They're conflating Mr. Bender, Kurt Bender, with Bender Management, and they are separate as the Limited Liability Company Act prescribes. They are two separate entities. Bender Management has no ownership interest in Medina Terrace, but Mr. Bender has an indirect financial interest in the entity that ultimately bought these units. So it is our position that Rule 305 applies to this matter as well. And because there's no tangible remedy that this court can give any longer, because the units have been transferred to a third party, the appeal should be dismissed for that basis as well. With respect to the underlying judgment, as this
counsel, I need to ask you about that, because okay. It's your burden to prove that they're separate entities and that there's no common ownership, and they have the same address, they have the same registered agent. There's a lot of similarity between the two entities.
Well, that may be, but as I stated, we've provided an affidavit. There's been no counter affidavit. And we have established that Bender Management has no ownership interest in Medina Terrace. We set forth who the members of Medina Terrace are, and it is not Bender Management. And we've also provided affidavit testimony that it doesn't have some lower level interest in the purchasing entity either.
Now, did you provide the information with regards to the principles of Bender Management?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that question.
Did you provide an affidavit with regards to the principles of Bender Management?
There's only one, and that is Kurt Bender. So yes, that was supplied in our supplemental record. With respect to the summary judgment piece, as this court is aware, you do not need to rely on the reasoning that the trial court provided for purposes of granting summary judgment or affirming that judgment. Here, the court can affirm on any basis that was presented to the lower court. And we did provide other bases for the summary judgment that was granted in favor of Bender Management, apart from solely focusing on this vote count, which again, you know, plaintiffs are trying to argue that it is an individual claim, but vote count of a on a sale vote can only be impact the entire association. So it's a derivative action. And again, they didn't establish their standing to either assert the derivative action on behalf of the entire association or to bring individual claims for their own rights. This argument wasn't really fully addressed either in the trial court by plaintiffs or on appeal. We do think that summary judgment would have been proper for the reasons the court gave and for the numerous reasons set forth in the briefs in the lower court. In fact, the motion to compel Mr. Malik's continued deposition was brought by plaintiffs after plaintiffs had filed the response to the motions for summary judgment. Discovery had closed at that point, and the court had addressed that issue as well. So it wasn't a matter of not allowing these plaintiffs an ability to depose anyone and everyone they wanted to. Discovery, in fact, had been extended a few times for them to do it. They've been given ample opportunity to do so. And, you know, the court just found that they'd waited too long on the one hand, and their 191B affidavit was insufficient on the other hand. We also argued that vendor management would have been entitled to judgment on the pleadings because, again, the relief sought is declaratory. Vendor management is not a necessary party to this action. And if all they're seeking is declaratory judgment, they're seeking a remedy for past actions, not future behavior. Everything that they complain about occurred prior to the sale vote. So they were aware of the constitution of the board before the sale vote. They were aware of the sale vote about to occur before the sale vote. And they were aware that they were allegedly pressured before the sale vote, and yet they filed nothing. That would have been the moment, if any, were the appropriate moment to bring a declaratory judgment action. But that's not what they did. They waited until afterward and then brought such an action. We also asked that the appeal be dismissed with respect to vendor management under Rule 341, because as you may note in plaintiff's opening brief, they make effectively no argument with respect to vendor management. In fact, in the lower court, counsel admitted that the only reason vendor management sued was to put it on notice. That's not an appropriate reason to file suit in the first instance. And it's certainly not an appropriate reason to bring us along for the ride on appeal. Which brings me to our final request, which is for 375 sanctions. Vendor management has expended a lot of fees and time with respect to this appeal, and plaintiffs admit that they don't have any real claim against vendor management. Vendor management does not own any of the units. It is it's not its nominee that owns the units. So there is no reason for vendor management to have been sued in first instance, and there's certainly no reason for them to be brought in on this appeal, and we would ask for an opportunity to file an appropriate fee petition after this argument. Thank you.
Questions from the bench for Mr. Porta?
None.
Okay. Mr. Mitchell, you may respond.
May it please the court. Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Nick Mitchell. I represent the Cove Condominium Association, also known as Medina Terrace Condo Association. I think Ms. Forte has already addressed the motion to dismiss. I would add, however, that even beyond a procedural motion to dismiss, I think substantively speaking, the plaintiffs just simply lack any standing to assert any claims related to the association since they are no longer members of the association. If you were to consider what would happen if this court were to reverse the trial court's ruling, I'm not sure what relief or remedy could be made available to the plaintiffs that would restore them into any position that they were before they filed this action, since they have all sold their units since then. The proper procedure would have been to file a motion to stay the enforcement of that order instead of just getting a cash transaction for the property and then conveying it to somebody else. There's no way to provide a remedy that would actually adequately address their claims. With respect to the substantive issues that the appellant has addressed with respect to the condo association's claims, it sounds like there's really two primary issues. One is the trial court's denial of a motion for an extension of time to respond to the summary judgment pursuant to the Rule 191B affidavit that was submitted. The court acknowledged in its ruling that the 191B affidavit was woefully insufficient. I think that was the exact language from the order, from the transcript. Plaintiffs acknowledge in their appellant brief that it does not meet the satisfaction of 191B's requirements. They don't indicate what information they expect to obtain, why they can't get it from other sources, or what other efforts they've taken to try to obtain it. For instance, to the extent that counsel or plaintiffs have concerns over the votes that were submitted or the methodology that was used to submit the vote, they could have contacted each individual unit owner at the association to ask them, is this your vote? Did you submit this to the association? How did you submit this to the association? Is it consistent with how you wanted to vote for this particular sale? They didn't do that. They took a total of 3 depositions only over the course of more than a year. 2 of them were for 2 board members, and the 3rd was of Omar Malik, who is an attorney representing the association. I think this is a good time to discuss the Malik deposition, since that is another aspect of their appeal. The plaintiffs asked the courts to reverse the trial court's decision on the basis that Mr. Malik apparently did not have accurate testimony during his affidavit on the purported basis that it was contrary to what he said during his deposition. We need to provide some context to how that deposition was conducted. Mr. Malik was not a party to the lawsuit. He was an attorney representing the association. The association received a notice of deposition, not a subpoena, but a notice of deposition from Mr. Malik's deposition. The association's counsel, concerned with potential privilege issues, reached out to plaintiff's counsel immediately and inquired as to the purpose of the deposition and objected to the potential scope. The association's counsel reached an agreement with plaintiff's counsel that we would only present Mr. Malik if we agreed on the scope of the discovery. And the agreed upon scope pursuant to plaintiff's counsel was Mr. Malik was to be asked questions about the meetings that took place to discuss the Section 15 sale and his service as an MC of these meetings. Based upon that agreement, Mr. Malik voluntarily attended his deposition. During the deposition—
Counsel, was there written discovery that occurred prior to that? And was Mr. Malik disclosed as a witness?
There was written discovery issued and disclosed between the parties. As to whether Mr. Malik was identified as a witness, I don't believe so. I don't know that he would have been a witness until, because this is part of the problem with the suit really in general. The underlying complaint that's at issue was very bare bones. There's only a handful of vague allegations, and the only one pertinent for this issue was this notion that the ballots were not tabulated with the appropriate weighted percentages. Each owner at the association has an ownership interest, and the allegation in the complaint was that when they tabulated these votes, they didn't use the proper weighted percentages. Therefore, there was no reason to believe that there would ever be a need to have Mr. Malik disclosed as a witness. The ballots and the proxies are what they are. The allocations and the spreadsheets are what they are.
It was your client's decision to use an affidavit signed by him in support of the motion for summary judgment. So in order to obtain the summary judgment, you used him as a witness. And that is something that is clearly foreseeable, because how you were trying to prove your case. If you didn't plan to use him as a witness, you didn't need to attach him to your motion for summary judgment.
So we only used him as part of our response to the motion. I'm sorry, in our reply, because in the response to the motion for summary judgment, there were arguments made for the first time that were challenging the methodology of how the votes were cast. So it was no longer about the weighted percentage. It was now challenging whether they were sent to the correct person, who the people were that were actually receiving the votes. There was a dispute, or they tried to insert a dispute as to the veracity of the documents themselves. So only at that point, when we were confronted with these new arguments that were not at all alleged in the complaint, did we come up with a response to it and a reply brief. And, you know, earlier there was a question as to whether counsel could have got this information from elsewhere. And the answer is that they absolutely could have. But there was, and we set a foundation for these documents, not just through Mr. Malik. We submitted 5 affidavits in total that authenticated these ballots and proxies that were cast and used in the tabulation. There were 4 board member affidavits in addition to Mr. Malik. So we, and those other four board member affidavits and Mr. Malik's affidavit were never refuted with a contrary affidavit. So with those being deemed admitted, the trial court had immense discretion at that point to determine that there was a proper authentication made for these documents. And moreover, we didn't really even need the documents. But to Ms. Forte's point, your honors can confirm the or affirm the judgment at the trial court level for any reason. There were a number of different ways that the association established a foundation for these exhibits. It wasn't just the documents themselves. In fact, just the testimony and the affidavits saying the board members all confirmed that 75% of the owners voted in favor, that would be sufficient. We wouldn't even need the documents. We wouldn't even need those ballots and proxies to be in the evidence. We have affidavits saying that we did the tabulation, it's over 75%, and unless they present some evidence to refute that or a contrary affidavit, then it's deemed admitted. And so that was another reason the trial court could have properly determined that we were entitled to summary judgment.
Mr. Mitchell, did those affidavits explain how they came to those conclusions, or did they simply state that the tabulations were done, they were done correctly, and this was the outcome?
It doesn't get into too much detail in the terms of the methodology as to how the tabulation took place. It was just that we've received, here are the ballots and proxies that we received as an association in connection with the Section 15 vote. After our tabulation, we've determined that more than 75% of the owners voted in favor.
Thank you.
Any further questions, Mr. Mitchell?
Not for me.
None.
No. Okay, very good. Mr. Lubin, you may reply.
I think you just heard it. Respectfully, I think you just heard it. The first that we became aware, and I say we, I mean the plaintiffs in this case, became aware of the fact that the tabulation was done under Mr. Malik. I called him Malik before, I apologize. Under Mr. Malik was at that deposition. I mean, we didn't know how. And by the way, one of the claims in the complaint was that the tabulation wasn't done appropriately. And there the focus was that the proper weight wasn't given to each unit owner, given the percentage ownership of each unit. I'm sorry, the percentage of the, I think it had to do with the size of the unit. But in order to get to that, in order to lay the foundation even for that, you would need to show the votes. And so what we found during the case was, it's Claudia Moore that did the votes. All right, well, what do you know? It's not Claudia Moore that did the votes, it's Malik. And by the way, you don't get to learn anything more about Malik. And so they want to have it both ways, right? They played hide the football with respect to who counted the votes. And then once it finally comes up, it's attorney client. The guy's an attorney. How could he possibly be? How could he possibly testify as to anything? Well, if he's a witness, he isn't the attorney. He's a witness, and he was a witness. You know how I know he's a witness? There was an affidavit that he signed, in which he stated, "I was the one that oversaw the votes," and it was that affidavit. It was based on that affidavit that the trial court found that they win summary judgment, because obviously the votes were done appropriately. This attorney said so. But that's not foundation, and we certainly should have been given an opportunity to delve into with Bender whether the votes were counted properly, how they were counted, all the other things that I've discussed. Bender as well, by the way, wants to have it both ways. It's sanctionable. How could we possibly be part of this? We didn't do anything. But at the same time, it's a nominee of theirs that took over the property. And by the way, I'll quote the language, right? Counsel had said that it's not a nominee of theirs at all. Kurt Bender only has an indirect economic interest. I believe that's a quote. Well, the contract says that Bender's interests may only be assigned by buyer to a title-holding entity in which the buyer or its principals are a member, shareholder, or partner, or otherwise hold a direct economic interest, in which event assignee, that's any one of those, shall assume all of the obligations of buyer under the agreement. In other words, the buyer is a nominee and steps into the shoes of Bender. You know, Kurt Bender has a direct economic interest. He has to, otherwise they're in violation of the complaint. I'm sorry, the contract. And certainly no one has come here today and said to your honors, it's okay because Kurt Bender's in direct violation of the contract. He either is or he isn't. He has a direct economic interest. And Bender, by the way, meaning the party, not Kurt Bender, Bender must have a direct economic interest because it was conveyed, this property apparently transferred over. Well, no, they didn't do it that way. They created a new LLC and that LLC took ownership of the interest that Bender had. But the contract is with Bender. So of course they're a party here. If they want us to add Medina Properties, fine, we could do that, I suppose. But when the lawsuit was filed, it didn't exist. It was perfectly normal and rational to sue Bender. The appeal was taken from the complaint in which Bender was a party, and Bender remains a party with a direct economic interest. And if they don't have a direct economic interest, the contract wasn't followed. I don't have any more to say. I'm happy to entertain questions. I realize I do have more time, but I don't feel the need to speak.
So, Lubin, what did you file for a stay?
Oh, simple. In order to file for a stay, they'd have to put up a bond. They can't afford it. There's no way.
And if you're successful and this is remanded and the trial court changes its decision, how do we undo this? Are your clients ready to pay the money back? What is the status of the property?
Sure. A number of possible ways. The individual unit owners could be given their units. That's one possibility. Another possibility is that the sale.
They have to give the money back though too, also, right?
I assume they would have to do that. Yes, I assume they would have to do that. Yeah. And they were given the money. If they can't pay the money back, then no, I don't think they get their units back. I think that's true.
That's all I had.
Okay. Thank you, dude. Any others? Questions? No?
No.
Okay. Well, very good. Thank you, counsel, all for your arguments in this matter this afternoon. It'll be taken under advisement and a written disposition shall issue. At this time, the clerk of our court will escort you out of our remote courtroom.